Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. Today, Mark Schindler is here, and we are going to break down the Pascal Siakam trade that occurred overnight again. I keep waking up with these deals that happened. This one at least occurred at like 6:30 a.m. my time. I looked, I saw a message from a source league-wide, let's call it, and he said, there it is on the Siakam. And I was like, okay, so that must be the Siakam deal got done. Looked at Twitter. There we are. Pascal Siakam goes from the Toronto Raptors to the Indiana Pacers for Bruce Brown, Jordan Wara, Kyra Lewis, three first-round picks coming from the Indiana Pacers. Two of those picks are the Indiana Pacers' own this season and in 2026. The 2026 pick is top four protected. The other pick is also a 2024 pick. It will essentially be the worst selection of the Clippers or Thunder this season, depending on who finishes lower in the standing. So you're looking at something like the 25th, the let's call it 28th pick in the 2024 NBA draft. To break it all down, Mark Schindler is here. Mark, what's going on, man?
A lot. As a, I guess you could call me a, not really a fan. I'm leaning back into fandom, but as somebody who grew up as an Indiana Pacers fan, I am ecstatic, man. This is so dope because, I don't know. I mean, obviously we'll get into it, but the Pacers just kind of historically were never a team that made these kind of big swing trades. It was always the let's go, you know, find like, okay, we'll trade a late first for Thad Young because he's somebody who can round out our core. Or, you know, we'll go and try and find somebody who we think if we get them healthy and consistent, like a TJ Warren, they become more valuable playing for us than elsewhere. So like, to see this team like really swing on what some could consider a pretty risky move is, I don't know. It's just very cool to watch as somebody who, you know, grew up as a Pacers fan.
Yeah, this is a full scale buy deal. This is them going in and saying, hey, we really love our core. We really love our young core that we're not going to move in a Pascal Siakam deal. That was one of the most interesting pieces of this trade for me, in my opinion, at least, yeah, is the fact that none of Jairus Walker, Ben Mathurin, or Andrew Nembhard are a piece of this trade. It feels like to me the Pacers love what they have. They love their roster. They love their team. And that they wanted to buy and go all in on this season. And I love this trade for them. We actually did a podcast over the summer talking about the Pascal Siakam trade market when it looked like he might get traded over the course of the summer. And I think you and I both thought that Siakam was an unbelievable fit in Indiana. And then throughout the course of the season, I've also continued to say that I think Indiana makes the absolute most sense as they've gotten better and better and made their run in the in-season tournament, everything like that. I've just felt like Siakam made even more sense for them as the year went on. I love the basketball fit for Siakam. I think it just makes an immense amount of sense. I think that the price point here is probably about right. I know that won't sit well with some Raptors fans, but they kind of got backed into a corner for reasons that maybe we'll discuss here momentarily. But I kind of want to keep it on the Pacers here for a second because I think that this is such a important deal for them moving forward. Siakam is eligible to sign a 2-year, $81 million extension. I frankly can't imagine that he's going to sign that, just because if you look around the marketplace and what it could be in the offseason, I cannot imagine Siakam not getting a 4-year extension at this point, or a 4-year contract at this point, just because there's not a lot out there. He's going to get a max from somebody. So you almost certainly wait if you're Siakam to do something there. But if I'm Indiana, I feel like I have literally the perfect basketball ecosystem to be able to allow Pascal Siakam to thrive in. And I'm willing to bet on playing next to a guy like Tyrese Halliburton, who we know is going to get Siakam touches in the exact spots that he wants touches, playing in arguably the most well-spaced offense in the league, playing in a dynamic transition offense, is probably the exact ecosystem that you would love to see if you are Pascal Siakam looking for a new environment to play basketball in. So if I'm Indiana, I feel great about betting on myself with this Siakam deal and saying, we're going to be able to retain this guy and we're going to be willing to give up the assets to get him, even if there is a risk factor here.
Yeah, I think there are a couple things that I'd hit on it. First, exactly like you're saying, I think so much of this year has been kind of trial by committee in the front court for the Pacers, which, to be fair, like, it has worked. I think a lot of that is due to the system. And, when you pull apart how this team has played against the top teams in the league, I think you see some of the drawbacks with all the options that they have in the front court outside Miles Turner. And I think, to me, because one of the questions we got, opening this up was, there's a logjam in the front court. So what does that mean? To me, this is them making this move is showing, like, you don't have a lot of faith in that group at the highest levels. And that's why you go out and you get somebody like Pascal, who you can have questions about his shot, which I'm sure we'll talk about, what that means moving forward. But I think, okay, you can – Jalen Smith is he shoots, but he doesn't get defended like it. Obi Toppin will shoot. He doesn't get defended like it. And Pascal doesn't have the same issues on the other end that those two do, while also bringing more for you offensively. So I think, to me, it's just – especially when you talk about the price point, it's pretty no-brainer for me. I really love how this has turned out. And then I think the other thing that – we don't even have to talk about this now, but what is most intriguing to me is, I think a lot of people look at this as, oh, well, they haven't been playing Jarris that much and this and that. And I think – I don't know, the more that I have, been in this, looking at things topically with respect to player development, like, I think it's okay to have guys who come in and are playing over lottery picks. Like, unless you are a guy who comes in and is an immediate home run, it's just very unrealistic to, especially with the way that the plan has started to redirect how teams approach things. And how that's played out in parity. I just think it's a lot harder for coaching staffs to buy in to play a guy who's not quote unquote ready all the time. So I think for me, this is about Jarris is going to be a depth guy at the beginning. And then as he keeps developing, we'll see how that plays out. But I think for me, like, again, this is all about them taking the next step and continuing to build. And it's easy to forget, like, I think so often we look myopically at, like, well, you have this much team control, like Tyrese Halliburton is there for 5 years. Yeah, but you have to make him happy every single year. I'm not saying that, quote unquote, like, this is all about, like, oh, well, he runs the franchise or something like that. But it's like, okay, well, yes, you have a long-term vision in view, but you have to build on that now. It can't just be that long-sighted. Like, you have to be able to have steady enough growth here to have people bought in and continuing to doing that moving forward. So that's a long-winded answer, but that was all the immediate stuff that I thought of right when I got into this.
Yeah, and Jarris Walker, for reference, in the G League this year, averaging 24.2 points, 5 rebounds, 3.3 assists versus 2.7 turnovers, shooting 51% from the field, 44% from 3 on 7 3-point attempts per game, by the way. Shout out Jarris Walker. He's working on that jumper. And here's the thing. If Jarris Walker can shoot, and I don't think he can shoot yet on an NBA court against NBA defenders closing out on him, making him speed things up. But if he can shoot in 2 years, you can play Jairus Walker and Pascal Siakam together. And then you have the makings of an incredible defense next to Tyrese Halliburton, which might be what you need long term in order to make him as successful as humanly possible. Like, if you can get Jairus Walker, Pascal Siakam, Miles Turner all on the court together, and if you can mix and match two of those three almost at all times on the court, it significantly upgrades your defensive upside, which is what you need to make this work around Tyrese Halliburton long term. So I love that idea of this deal. I love the fact that they kept those guys. I think that it's so much smarter for them to move two first round picks in a 2024 draft that I have an enormous amount of questions about, as well as a 2026 pick that they maintain top four value on in case of disaster, as a team like Memphis is learning. You never know what's going to happen with injuries, obviously, in any season. Keeping that is a real value. We'll see, you know, what the rest of it looks like for the Pacers. But in terms of just purely the basketball fit for Pascal Siakam here, I just want to rattle off some stats in terms of what really matters here for Siakam. Pascal Siakam is one of, let's call him, the best drivers, best mid-post players, best rim pressure guys in the NBA scoring around the basket. You would agree with that, Mark?
100%.
He is absolutely, utterly elite at it, in my opinion. If you look at the run of games he was on, basically from the start of December onward, he was averaging 25 points, 5 rebounds, 5 assists, shooting 58% from the field. He was actually shooting pretty well from 3 for an extended period of time for the first time, actually in quite a long time. In his recent career, and making 76% of his 6 free throw attempts per game. I think everybody thinks of Indiana as this run and shoot, transition only attack. Yeah, they definitely do a lot of that. Transition is going to be an enormous part of what makes Pascal Siakam a success in Indiana. He is a monster out on the break. He is absolutely able to sprint. He plays with an exceptional motor. He is very fast. He covers ground quickly. Tyrese Halliburton is going to be looking for him constantly on runouts, on trailer situations where he can dive to the rim once the defense is bent. It's going to work incredibly well out on the break. But more importantly, in the half court, I think it's going to work exceptionally well. The Pacers score 45.5% of their points in the paint. That's actually top 10 in the league. Again, not a team that is just some like, hey, let's spread them out and shoot threes team, like I think has been displayed a little bit occasionally. They actually lead the NBA in points in the paint per game. They are third in the NBA in drives per game, in part because of how well they space the court, because of how well they keep things keep driving lanes open. They're capable of getting that kind of penetration. They're third in the NBA in points off of drives. This fits really well with Siakam's skill set. They're going to open things up for Siakam. They're going to have 4 shooters around him, and they're going to say, just go. Like, you're going to be able to create half-court offense in a real substantial way. I love all of that. The transition numbers, you know, they're third in points per game off of turnovers. According to Synergy, they're the third. They are the team that has the third highest percentage of their possessions in transition, and they are tied for the most points per game in transition. They are top 10 in field goal percentage in transition. They're top 9 in effective field goal percentage in transition. I think that all of this is tailor-made for what makes Siakam what he is. This is one of the best fits in terms of a trade, matching a guy's skill set with his new team, that I can remember in a long, long time. This just makes an immense amount of sense to me.
Yeah, I love what you hit on with Indiana, because I think They've just gotten kind of billed as a jump shooting team, which obviously is a big part of it. But they're, like you mentioned, I mean, they're fifth in rim rate in the league. A lot of it's them being a driving and offensive continuity team is what I look at. So I think in a lot of ways, to me, like, I think it's almost not to like get overly philosophical with it, but it's kind of like taking what the Utah Jazz did and adding in a lot more emotion with it and trying to be even more creative with it. And I think when you take Pascal, part of what I'm most interested in, I think when this team has had its biggest struggles is when things do bog down, because they don't necessarily have somebody who is adept at creating in that mid post elbow area when it's most difficult to. So I think when you take this, like, obviously Tyrese has grown quite a bit in that way. I think that's still a big area that he's going to keep growing into over this next contract. But like, you add Pascal as a guy who can be that dude in stretches and in moments, I think that's just so enticing to me. I'm really excited to see how Rick blends that all together. Cause one of the other things that's like kind of sneaky about this, like, Rick is tremendous at coaching guys like this. Like, I think, like, obviously they are not the same player, but like, I think about all the things he used to do with Josh Howard when he was in Dallas. Like, you can go all the way down the line of all the funky forwards that, that he's had, well, like, and made even, successful.
Like, another guy that fits this weirdly, and I'm not saying that Pascal is anywhere near as good, this guy, as good as this guy was, but like, finding ways to create space in the mid post, in the mid range for guys like Pascal Siakam, is exactly what Rick Carlisle did with Dirk Nowitzki back in the day. Mm-hmm. Obviously, very different players. They go about their game in different ways. But as a coach, what you're trying to set up in terms of spacing around that guy in the mid post at times, or, you know, in that like 18-foot mid-range area, you know, Pascal, you know, trying to drive, sometimes he's going to spin, sometimes he's going to, you know, just blow by a guy and get to the basket. The spacing principles aren't that different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think especially when you're talking about how they kind of operate in the same places, that totally makes sense to me. I think part of what's going to be really interesting too is like how they try and utilize this playmaking. Cause this hasn't been a group that is necessarily looking to do a lot out of, you know, playmaking from their bigs, from the elbows and whatnot. And I do think like, I would love to see them try and get some of that out of Pascal. Obviously, a lot of his stuff comes out of drives and creating from there. But just going to be interesting to see how they maybe try and cater some wrinkles in for that.
Yeah, how they get him touches there. And also, I'm going to be really interested to see how it evolves with him and Miles Turner, you know, necessarily who's going to screen. You know, how often are they setting double drags where Turner's going to pop and then Siakam's going to roll to the rim? How creative can Rick Carlisle get with those two? I think he can obviously get quite creative with those two. Miles has really, I think, improved as a ball handler, at least. I don't know that the passing has ever gotten to a level where I'm like, oh, yeah, like he's going to be able to make these like incredible short roll reads. But he's at least like comfortable enough putting the ball on the deck now to at least stop and like reset, or, you know, maybe even get to the basket, to where that's valuable in terms of being able to create a pick and roll attack that is versatile and multiple with Siakam. Like, you can have Siakam spacing on the weak side with Turner setting a screen where Turner's going to pick and pop, you know, maybe the defender, you know, the drop defender stays with Halliburton a little bit too long. You kick it to Turner. Maybe they decide to switch the action right, and you have to – Halliburton beats the big somehow, so the help has to come, and you have Siakam in the corner. So Siakam is there, and he's willing to cut as soon as his man ends up going to help onto Halliburton. There are just a lot of different ways, I think, to set up this offense. And that's before we even get to potential like Halliburton Siakam ball screen attacks, where you can throw Turner in the corner and then you have shooters around them. You know, you can throw Buddy Hield out there. You can throw Mathurin out there. You can throw Naismith out there. You can throw all of these different wings out there that are very, very good shooters that teams have to stay attached to. And it becomes really fucking hard to guard these guys. Like, if you have Siakam rolling to the rim, short rolling, maybe popping, he can do all of that stuff because he's so capable with the ball in his hands. it's just going to make Halliburton even more lethal, I think.
Yeah, and kind of like you're hitting on too. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what does or doesn't happen with Buddy Hield, because I know there have obviously been rumblings about that, and you know, him wanting to have a larger role and what that could look like. But I just think about like how lethal, you know, Fred VanVleet screening for Pascal could be and recreating some of that stuff with Buddy, but in a much better spaced remainder of the starting five. Like that, to me, that's like, I mean, you think about all the things that Pascal did as a driver and creator in Toronto, and then factor in that he was still operating with some of the worst. I said worst is maybe the improper way to say it, because they've done good things offensively, but like some of the most cramped spacing in the NBA over the last half decade since the championship. So like, obviously you can still do good things with interior playmaking and whatnot, but when you're talking about somebody who is creating downhill that operates best from the mid range, and you talk about what the spacing is going to be now, like that's just, he's never really had that kind of spacing to the degree he's going to see it in Indiana.
I'm glad you bring that up, Mark, because I grabbed an example of that to kind of showcase for people what exactly Siakam was dealing with in Toronto in terms of spacing. So you look at this play here. This is Siakam, you know, gets a touch in the mid post, right? He has Max Christie on him. I believe, is that Dennis up in the corner, upper in the wing there around the crypto sign? Looks like Dennis on the wing. Anthony Davis is switched on to Dennis, but because Dennis is not a guy that teams are worried about shooting, Anthony Davis is just like all the way cramped into the paint already. You have a help man coming down here as well. You have Max Christie guarding Siakam here. You have, I can't tell who that is. Is that LeBron guarding Gary Trent? Wouldn't really make sense rotationally for them. No, that's D'Angelo. Yeah, sorry. Couldn't tell by the hair.
Oh, you're good.
So you have D'Angelo Russell has 1 foot in the paint. Anthony Davis has 1 foot in the paint. Rui has 1 foot in the paint because he's guarding Scotty Barnes in the corner. And then you have your primary defender here. So you have three help defenders already with 1 foot in the paint because they know that Siakam is trying to drive here. That's the whole end goal. So you're going to see the drive. D'Lo kind of like gives like a soft dig, but not really. Like he kind of stunts it more than anything and then kind of goes for a swipe. Rui comes all the way in to help. He is at the basket. He is going to try and contest this here. Siakam gets the kick out, but it's to Scotty Barnes, and like, God loves Scotty Barnes. He's been great. But like, this is the kind of difficulty spacing that you see a little bit too often in Toronto. In Indiana, because, you know, guys like Aaron Naismith, because guys like Buddy Hield, like if that's Buddy Hield instead of, you know, let's call it Dennis Schroeder, if that's Tyrese Halliburton instead of Gary Trent Jr., both of whom are, I don't know, two of the 20 best shooters in the league at the very least, if not two of the 10 best shooters in the league. D'Angelo Russell has to be attached on the wing. Anthony Davis has to be attached on the wing here. You can't leave those guys at all. You might have, you know, instead of Scotty Barnes, you'd have maybe Miles Turner in the corner there. Miles' guy might help off, but you're not getting those two guys at the elbows sagging in, which is the critical thing. And that's going to allow Siakam to have a much easier time, in my opinion, getting downhill in circumstances like this. It's going to make life just so much easier, I think, for Siakam to score and have an enjoyable basketball experience offensively.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing too, cause like, you know, people could look at it and nitpick and be like, well, the spacing, you know, every team's going to have possessions like that. But to me, it's more about the pace that the team plays within the half court. Cause the Raptors, even when they've had decentish spacing, like they still play generally kind of slower in the half court. And to be fair, like that's one of the things that I will be interesting to see, because not like I would never say that Pascal is like a guy who is a ball stopper, but he definitely likes to probe more. Like he's not necessarily a quick rip and go kind of person. Like he likes to set up, he likes to go. But I think again, like when you talk about what that's going to look like, it's going to be about blending the two things together. I don't think it's about like necessarily just like fully doing it the quote unquote pacer way or whatever. So I'm going to be really interested to see what that looks like. But I totally agree on the spacing difference. And yeah, it's a lot of fascinating stuff to think about.
So another piece worth discussing here for the Pacers, and that's where we're going to talk about the Raptors here in a minute. Losing Bruce Brown like is a factor, I think. What have you thought of Bruce Brown this season with the Pacers and his impact there?
I think he's been solid. Like, he's been important for them as a guy who they can throw on multiple players defensively. I will say, like, I don't think he's been amazing defensively this year. Like, not that he's been bad. Like, again, like, you're talking about a guy who's been solid, but he's 6'4" and often gets overtaxed with having to guard guys who are way bigger. And so I think inherently there are just some difficulties with that. I've loved what he's done offensively with the group. Like, again, when you talk about a team that is primarily running three, sometimes four guard lineups, having a guy like him who can really do a lot of different things and do them at a level that meets a lot of thresholds, like, that's important. I think, like, the decision-making has been good. Obviously the shot's been a little bit up and down, but when you talk about somebody who can just be an effective play finisher, that's huge with everything he brings. But I think, you know, you just talk about, okay, well, now we have Pascal Siakam, who's bigger, longer, stronger, better, in the Bruce Brown role for us, but he's going to do more things and it's going to be a little bit different. Like, obviously I do think it hurts to lose him. And I think, you know, I saw some comments about, like, oh, well, you know, it feels weird to trade him in, like, the first year of his deal. I think this was always on the table. Like, this team did not have a lot in terms of movable salaries. And I think a large part of signing Bruce to that deal, like, obviously, like, you want to be cool with his agent and be like, hey, you know, we are offering your guy a big salary because we have the money to do it. We think he's going to be an impactful player on our team and he's going to look good for us. And then you can get him to a new place, see what it looks like.
Yeah.
So I think for me, like, it definitely, like, I would love to have Bruce and Pascal on my team. But when you talk about, okay, if when you're like, when you're looking at having one or the other, or you know, what the roles are, I think for me, it's awesome. Like, I'm in for it. I'm going to, like, we'll probably talk about Bruce with the Raptors later, but yeah, that's where I'd be at on it. How about you?
I think Bruce started the season really, really well for the Pacers. Like, he was knocking down shots a little bit more consistently, it felt like. And then that turned, defensively, again, like, wasn't quite like the menace that, like, he can often be, like the disruptor that I feel like he can often be. I don't think he was bad on defense necessarily. I think that, you know, the Pacers obviously just had, like, structural limitations in terms of size a lot of the time out there, size speed combination, it felt like, a lot of the time. So it was often hard, I think, for him to maybe be as disruptive as what he can be. But I generally agree with you that I don't think he's been quite as good as he was, like, say, in Denver last year defensively. And yeah, like, look, when you sign a deal like this where it is a 1-year deal for essentially what is a balloon payment, right? Like, Bruce Brown, God love him, like, great basketball player, fantastic, like, useful player, just had an awesome season with Denver Nuggets. Bruce Brown is not quite like a $22 million a year player. He's a good player. Like, he's a player that's worth probably a little bit more than the mid-level, but you sign him to this big number knowing that, like, hey, this is more than what he would get on the market. You also sign this deal that's exceptionally, you know, friendly from a team perspective in the second year and that it has a team option. I think that that kind of stuff comes with an understanding that there is, like, a potential that a trade could come down the road, even, you know, 3 months after you start playing with the team. So that's not surprising to me. Like, I wouldn't say that, like, I thought that a Bruce Brown trade was coming, but I never ruled it out, I guess, is kind of what I would say, just based on him being there for a year. I don't know that I saw him as a bigger trade candidate than, like, Buddy Hield from a salary matching perspective. Agreed. But structurally, the reason that you do it this way is so that you don't have to include guys like, you know, Nembhard, Walker, Mathurin, Obi Toppin, Jalen Smith, right? Who it seems like the Pacers would prefer to keep based off of the way they structured this deal by doing Bruce Brown. What was this? Bruce Brown, Jordan Wara, and then roping in the Pelicans and having them reroute Kyra Lewis up to Toronto. That's how you kind of make it work around that a little bit easier structurally from a financial perspective within the trade. It makes more sense doing that because, like, if it was Buddy Hield, I believe the trade does not work as, like, Buddy Hield, Jordan Wara, Kyra Lewis for Pascal. It does work with Bruce's slightly bigger salary. That's to get into, like, the mechanics of why I think that this was Brown versus Buddy Hield. Okay, we've talked for 30 minutes about the Pacers. Now we're on to the Raptors. The Raptors are in an utterly fascinating position now. Let's start with this. Did you feel like they got enough for Pascal Siakam in this trade where they get three first round picks? Again, I'll note what those picks are. Indiana's 2024 first round pick, which is, you know, probably going to end up something 15 to 22, let's call it. The worst pick in 2024 of Oklahoma City or the Clippers, which will probably end up 25 to 28, something like that. And then they also get the Pacers 2026 first round pick, in addition to Bruce Brown, Kyra Lewis, and Jordan Wara.
Yeah. I mean, you know me, I always look at things a little bit more optimistically. And I always try and be fair with it. But to me, like, I do think this is a failure from the Raptors. And I think I don't mean that lightly.
Like, I don't think I've ever heard you directly call something a failure. So I am fascinated by this response right now.
Yeah. I think with respect to this, this actual, like, where it is in the moment. Yeah. I think, like you said at the beginning, I think it's right value, but I think that's kind of the problem that they let it get to this moment. Yeah. Like, respectfully, we've been talking about this show on the show for almost 2 years now about how it's probably time to just really shake things up and make things different. And, like, can you make the case, like, oh, well, having Pascal there was big for Scottie's development. I'm sure that Pascal had a positive impact on Scottie developmentally. But when you talk about sheer asset value and the way that this team has operated, like, I think Masai is one of the great executives in the league. I'm not trying to diminish that, but I do think that he has not done a good job with what this trade ended up being and what they end up getting back, because these picks are not good with respect to what it should be. I mean, like, if you talk about what this is 2 years ago, and I don't mean to make it all hypothetical and retrospective, but it's hard not to when you look at, I mean, like, there have been, we've been hearing about Pascal Siakam trade rumors since it feels like just after the bubble season. So, like, it's just from that perspective, I do think it is hard to look at this extremely positively. I think you can look at it as maybe they're able to flip Bruce Brown and make some other stuff shake with that. But again, like, I don't think that Bruce is necessarily netting you some giant positive back. I think, okay, you get a flyer back in Kira Lewis, which I think is interesting. I would love to see what he can look like in a new setting. I know that's been reported on for a minute that he was going to be out of New Orleans by the trade deadline because they just didn't have room to play him. But again, overall, like, they're not getting back some super exciting prospect. They're not getting back even a more project type player that is going to take time to develop. It's just, it looks sexier because it's first round picks and people can look at it and say, look, we have three first round picks. But in reality, what these three first round picks might end up looking like in the next 2 or 3 years, I do think that this is a pretty big mistake that it has taken this long to get done.
I think that what this is I think you're 100% right. And it's kind of how I feel about the deal as well. It's just that endings are hard.
Yeah. Right?
Like, endings are hard. This is really, I mean, look, like, all due respect to Chris Boucher, who was still on the Raptors roster and was on the 2019 title team. This is really kind of the end of the road for that 2019 title team. They are now fully into a new era. You look at who the guys were on that team. Kawhi Leonard, you know, left immediately, now plays for the Clippers. Kyle Lowry left, 2 years later, now plays for the Miami Heat. Siakam is now a member of the Indiana Pacers. Danny Green is retired. Fred VanVleet now plays for the Houston Rockets. Serge Ibaka is retired. Marc Gasol is retired. OG Anunoby now plays for the Knicks. Jeremy Lin, I don't believe, is retired. I don't want to misspeak on where he's playing. I'm not totally sure. Jonas Valanciunas now play. It was moved midseason, if I remember correctly, that year. He, you know, now plays for the Pelicans. Norman Powell now plays for the LA Clippers. So the bones of what that team was are now all gone. And I think that the Raptors held on to the bones of that team, which is the best in franchise history, and their NBA title team, and a team that that fan base like really connected with, and obviously so for so many reasons. There was so much reason to have a lot of love and affection for that team. I think that the Raptors front office probably felt similarly and let it get too far down the road. In terms of what the value is, if we're speaking, you know, outside of a vacuum here, or if we're speaking in a vacuum, I'm sorry, I think this is more than I expected them to get for Siakam if you told me yesterday that they were trading Siakam to the Pacers. I don't think I quite expected 3 first round picks plus Bruce Brown, who I think they're going to be able to reroute for another first round pick if they really would want to. I don't know what their plans are with Bruce Brown. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute. But like, if you tell me that like you get the equivalent of basically 4 first round picks for a guy that expires on June 30th, I would not have bought that. Like I that would have surprised me. But A, the pick value matters. These are not great picks for reasons we'll discuss momentarily, maybe when we dive into this a little bit more. But also, how you got here matters. If you had moved Siakam in the summer, I really find it hard to believe that you wouldn't have gotten something better.
Yeah.
If you had moved him last deadline, which I thought was like a real conversation worth having, I think you would have gotten something like very real from somebody. And it just speaks to, I think, missed opportunities maybe by this Raptors front office in potentially retooling on the fly. And we're seeing Golden State go through it to some extent right now as well. Golden State is trying to figure out, do we hang on to the past or do we pivot into the future? Golden State obviously has won, you know, numerous more titles than the Raptors, and I think there's probably a little bit more reason to hang on there. But they're going through an iteration of this in some way where oftentimes it's better to be early than to be late on these things. If you're early on these things, you don't lose Fred VanVleet for literally nothing. Mm-hmm. If you're early, you get a better return for Pascal Siakam. I don't think any of us really thought the Raptors had a significant chance to win the title or to even really make like a serious playoff run in each of last season and this season. Just the reality of the situation, especially by the deadline last year. And I think that making that mental pivot toward we would rather be early than be late on these things also stops you from trading what might end up being like a really valuable first round pick now for Jakob Poeltl to the San Antonio Spurs. Like essentially what Masai Ujiri did was punted on the 2024 draft class because, you know, like I've been saying, like people, you know, who cover the draft have been saying for at least a year and a half now, the 2024 draft does not seem very good. It's not a strong draft at the top in terms of high upside value. The Raptors have a chance to like go get some role players and go get like, if they evaluate well, they can go get guys that will be NBA players in this draft for sure. Like these aren't valueless picks by any stretch, but I don't find it wildly likely that they're going to find their next star. And now they remain in this weird liminal space where, honestly, like there's a real case for them to still try and make the play-in and have that pick transfer over to San Antonio this year so that you keep your, you know, high pick for 2025 potentially if your team isn't very good in 2025. And then like also not get your pick this year while you're in the middle of a rebuild in some way. Like it becomes a very complicated, convoluted conversation. And it's all because of how they've handled the ending here of this Raptors title team. And I think that at the end of the day, I think they handled it incorrectly, I think is the most reasonable way to say it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I know failure was definitely a harsh way to put it, but I think exactly like you're saying, like, it's just, getting the opportunity to, and this team has been good at evaluating talent. So like, I'm not questioning that, but again, it's all the opportunity cost of like, okay, well, I'm excited about if I trade Gary Trent and I have the opportunity to maybe get a few guys who can become better in that role with picks. When it's trading Pascal Siakam, and these are like those are the picks coming back. It just, it's the same point, but yeah, we definitely view it in the same light.
What do you think of this roster now moving forward? So they are led by Scotty Barnes, Emmanuel Quickley, RJ Barrett, Jakob Poeltl. Bruce Brown is on this roster. Kyra Lewis, Jordan Wara, Dennis Schroeder, Gary Trent Jr. is still here. What do you think this roster is capable of in the near term? Let's start there.
In the near term, I don't view them as like a real playoff threat unless some massive stuff happens. Like I think, there are good pieces here. Like obviously I think to me, when I just look at these past few trades together, the biggest thing for me is Emmanuel Quickley. Like Emmanuel Quickley has proven what he can do. He's established. And more importantly, I think like, as we've already seen to a degree in Toronto, like we've known that there's more for him to do on the table in a bigger role. And I think to me, it's all about expanding that alongside Scotty. Like that is the basis here. Like, figure out what you have here, because I think so much of what's been awesome about this year, the big thing to me, like what makes this year so important already is the growth that Scotty's shown. Like for him to get to this point as a shooter, you've talked about on the show a ton. For him to be here, like I think we're talking much more feasibly about a guy who can carry that much more of an offense. And when you get a guy like Emmanuel Quickley, that is like as good of a one that as you can pair with him in terms of stylistic, having that kind of style, having a guy who can be so good off ball, but also run lineups and be a quality defender, like that's awesome. But again, like you're thinking up and down, obviously RJ has been tremendous in Toronto. It feels like every single game has been a good game for him except for one. Obviously an important developmental bet, like how can he keep growing? What does that look like in a new system? I've been impressed so far. I want to see what that keeps looking like. But again, like you're talking about a group that is probably winning like 32 to 36 games, depending on what the vets are around them. Like, I don't think that, especially when you talk about like Indiana being a group that was in a tier slightly above there, they're expanding, going even higher now. The Knicks obviously took what they hope to be a step forward, adding OG. You have Miami, you have Cleveland. Like, there's still quite a bit farther down from everyone else. And I guess, it depends on immediate future, but I still think even next year, I don't view them as like if they make a play in, I don't think that would be surprising, but being like a real legit playoff team next year would be pretty surprising to me.
Yeah. So the reason I asked about the short term is because, the Spurs get their pick if it's outside of the top six, right? That's a really, really important point here. Trying to figure out if they're going to be able to maintain that selection or not. And if they want to, like, frankly, I don't know where the Raptors sit on that. Like, I know what I would want to do, but like, I would want that pick to transfer this year over to the Spurs. But I don't know how I feel about that or how they feel about that. Maybe the other side of it in terms of the long-term piece here, let's say shorter long-term, so maybe next 2 years, they would really need Emmanuel Quickley to be a dude, I think, to make that next step. And I love Emmanuel Quickley. I think there is a chance he is like a very significant dude. When we did the breakdown with John Macri on the OG and Anobi deal, I called that straight up. Like, I think that is the Emmanuel Quickley deal as much as it is the Ananobi deal. Yep. And I think Emmanuel Quickley's upside is enormous. I think that he is a perfect fit with Scotty Barnes. I would want to see those two play together at a really high level and just let those two rock and see what happens at the end of the year here. If you lose games, that's cool. If not, you know, probably helps your objectives as well, right? Like, that's fine. The Raptors generally are a team that have not wanted to like fall all the way back, right? They're a team that tries to stay competitive in general. So I think they're going to let like Scotty and Emmanuel Quickley and those guys rock a little bit. And then if it really turns here over the course of the next couple of months, you know, we saw when they were in Tampa and that was a totally different situation. They're away from home, everything like that, that maybe they will be willing to, you know, lose some games late in the year and see what happens. They might naturally lose games. The other piece of this that's hard, though, is that they are firmly in the play-in race, even at, what are they, 15 and 23 right now? Is that the right record?
Yeah, 15 and 25, I believe.
15 and 25. Even at 15 and 25, the bottom of the East is such a trash fire.
Yeah,
from 9 to 15. That they are firmly in the play-in picture still.
Yeah. Like it's like not even almost seven games up on Charlotte right now. And
yeah. That's... Like you look at the play-in picture right now. I believe that they are in 11th. Is that right?
They're 12th just behind Atlanta. And so Atlanta and Brooklyn are tied.
They're 12th behind Atlanta. Atlanta and Brooklyn are tied. Brooklyn is in 10th, if I remember correctly, at 16 and 23.
Yep.
They have like the very slight, you know, whatever a tiebreaker is at 39 games into the season. And then even Chicago is still only 19 and 23, and they're in 9th. So if Toronto is able to like pull off some wins here moving forward, that's like a very distinct possibility that they can still make the play-in. Again, like for that, for the Raptors, I think the goal here is just to like, not be one of the bottom six teams. They are currently, I think, the sixth worst team in the league. If you look at the bottom of the league right now, the Spurs are 7-32. I don't think that they get to the Spurs level. The Wizards are 7-32. I don't think they get to the Wizards level. The Pistons are 4-36. I mean, God love the Raptors if they get to the Pistons level. Jesus. The Blazers are 10-29, so they're 4.5 games up on the Blazers. That is, what, four teams right there? Fifth is the Grizzlies. They are currently tied with the Grizzlies at 15-25. Kind of a similar boat to the Grizzlies. The Grizzlies are much more injured than they are, though. Desmond Bane is going to miss some time. Marcus Smart is going to miss some time. The Grizzlies do like to be competitive in the same boat that the Raptors are. So could be a circumstance where it's Toronto and Memphis vying for something in that range. And then the other team that I didn't mention are the Hornets. They're 8-29. I can't imagine the Raptors being as bad as the Hornets have been the rest of the way, just because, you know, they're seven games up on the Hornets already, or maybe like six games up or something. Mm-hmm. So I think they have a good chance to like get outside of that. Certainly, I think they'll be outside of the bottom five at least. And it's kind of going to come down to like Memphis and Toronto, like which one wants to tank more, and then like lottery odds kind of thing.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's just a quick aside too. It is the Grizzlies season has been jarring, man. I never thought I would see a team as banged up as that. I think it was 20. It would have been 2017-18 because it was the year that they had Tyreek Evans, because 2018-19 was when Tyreek was in Indiana. But like that, I never thought I'd see a team as banged up as that Grizzlies team, because that was a team that went 25 deep that season because of how many two ways they had to sign. And this is shaping up to be just as bad, which is just insane. But yeah, point being, like it would take to drop seven games with 40 games remaining. That's like, you are winning less than 10 games the rest of the year. Like that is a lot.
And look, like this team might be a, this could be like a, oh man, 10-30 stuff. Cause that's like a 21 win pace. I don't think this team is that bad with how good Scotty is now.
Agreed.
Like, I think that with Scotty, I've generally liked what I've seen from Darko this year. Like, I wouldn't say that he looks like a real, like, difference maker. Like Will Hardy, when I watch Will Hardy, I'm like, okay, this is like a dude, is a coach. I don't know if I think that Darko is quite that based off of what I've seen, but like, not, I wouldn't rule it out necessarily either. And part of this is going to be dependent upon what the next steps are with the Raptors, yep, too. So let's talk about that. Next steps for the Raptors. We've kind of talked about Bruce Brown. Whether or not they keep Bruce Brown or not is an interesting discussion. I think they could get a first round pick for him. Like, if you're Oklahoma City and you have this enormous Davis Bertans contract that you can use to match this very easily, and you have this enormous cache of picks, that's a deal that makes a lot of sense to me for them. If you don't want to trust like Cason Wallace, if you want a different option other than Isaiah Joe, if you want a different option other than Lu Dort, you want like a bench ball handler option in addition to Josh Giddey, like having an experienced playoff guy in Bruce Brown seems valuable to me for Oklahoma City, seems valuable to me for Philadelphia, seems valuable to me for, you know, like Sacramento, honestly, could really use somebody like Bruce Brown. I think the Knicks could really use somebody like Bruce Brown. If they decided they wanted to move, you know, it's like an interesting kind of deal that I don't know if I would do if I was New York, but given that Fred Katz just reported like Quentin Grimes' general levels of unhappiness, what if you did like Fournier and Quentin Grimes for Bruce Brown?
I don't hate it. I think it just kind of brings up some of the same problems. Like, how can he and Josh Hart ever touch the floor together in like meaningful moments?
Yeah.
Cause that's already been an issue with Josh Hart and OG playing together. Like, to make it like unkind to Josh, like he's a good player, but I think you just look at some of the issues.
Well, it's been an issue for Dante and Grimes as well. Like, do you trust playing Dante and Bruce Brown together? I don't know the answer to that one either. So maybe New York's not as good, but like the Lakers, you could potentially do. Dallas, I think, could really use them. Golden State, like, that's a guy that would really help Golden State's defense right now. I don't know, like, if there's a, you know, maybe you do something like Chris Paul, you know, and, you know, a pick or something. I'm just like throwing shit at the wall at this point, but like Bruce Brown helps them quite a bit. I think Bruce Brown helps a significant amount of teams in the playoff picture right now. If you have a mechanism to get to $22 million from a trade perspective, getting Bruce Brown is like a win for you.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, even Dallas adding any kind of adding Bruce would be cool. Like, I think, you know, when you talk about like looking at some of the other teams, like OKC would be so interesting to me because I just have no idea how to think about what they're going to approach with this or like how they want to approach it. Because like, I mean, exactly like you're mentioning, like, okay, cool. Well, I love Aaron Wiggins. I love all, like, pretty much every player on that roster, but like, okay, so you're taking all those minutes and saying, here's 20 minutes of Bruce Brown, maybe a little bit more. Like, that's a huge upgrade. Same thing for the Kings. I think the Kings are just like that. That one actually probably makes the most sense to me. But then again, it even becomes the same thing of like, all right, well, the Kings really need somebody who's like 6'6 or 6'7. But like, even then, like, adding Bruce would be huge for them. Yeah, there's a lot of teams should look into him. Even like Milwaukee is the team that I would be most interested to see if they even poke around on it. I just don't think they have the stuff to actually make it happen.
Yeah. They just unfortunately like don't have a mechanism to be able to do that, I don't think. Like, another team, I mean, Bruce Brown would be awesome in Miami.
Yeah. He's like, a very Miami player.
He'd be so fantastic there. And by the way, like, the Heat have this Kyle Lowry expiring contract. Like, that's an interesting, like, homecoming kind of deal that you could theoretically think about. You know, there's just a lot of different options here, I think, for the Raptors to be able to explore, at least for Bruce Brown. But if they decide not to trade Bruce Brown, the other piece of it is that Bruce Brown has a lot of value taking him, like, up to the draft or, like, you know, up until like June 30th or whatever his date is when you have to make a decision on his team option. I can look that up while we're talking. they have like a lot of cap space potentially next year. So it's not a matter of flexibility for them. It's more a matter of, is there a team out there that really wants Bruce Brown potentially next offseason and doesn't have a great mechanism maybe to acquire him in free agency? Is a team like that going to be willing to trade you something for Bruce Brown in order to acquire him because they can't do it otherwise? And now you have all of this draft capital as well. It's actually like a pretty interesting and valuable contract to take into the offseason as well from a flexibility perspective. But ultimately, like if you get a deal now that you like and feel comfortable with, I do think I would just move him at the end of the day.
No,
the other guys, and Bruce Brown, for what it's worth, his deadline is 2 days after the draft next year. So June 29th. So they would be able to take him through the draft if they want to. The other guys here that like, I wonder if it comes up. Jakob Poeltl, has 4 years left on his deal. I don't know how interested teams will be just given the length of his deal, but he's been quite good this year. I think like he has been valuable on defense. I think that he does a really good job being able to play within any sort of kind of ball screen action. They often play him in drop. Like, I think he's a quite good defender. You could look at somebody like Gary Trent on an expiring deal as well. I think he could probably help a few teams. I'm not totally sure who else here stands out, though. Maybe Dennis Schroeder. Schroeder was useful for the Lakers last year. I think there are at least a few options here that they could decide to move on from if they decide they want to like really take a step back. And if they decide that, getting rid of the vets would be one place.
Yeah, I think, like you mentioned, I think figuring out how to move Jakob would be fascinating because I just don't know what that looks like. Like you mentioned, I think he's a productive and useful player, but like he and Scotty have just not worked together. Like that has been really difficult as an offensive pairing. And he does good things defensively, but it's just like, again, the entire fit altogether is so awkward that I don't entirely – like I just don't know how to wrap my head around a team taking on that contract and what they're going to do with that. But
– well, like the problem there is that you look around the league right now, all of the bigs that like theoretically – could be available at the deadline. Like, for instance, like Daniel Gafford, right? Daniel Gafford, I think, is not as good as Jakob Poeltl. I think Jakob Poeltl's a better player. But Daniel Gafford is making $13 million versus $20 million. And if you're somebody like Dallas, for instance, and you want to continue developing Derek Lively over the course of the next 2 or 3 years, and you want to pair him with somebody, I think you'd probably rather prefer to pair him with Gafford as like a potential like starter backup situation one way or the other, because Gafford's just like a little bit cheaper at the end of the day.
100%.
So I'm not totally sure what to think of that yet. Like I don't know what to think like Jakob Poeltl's value would be at the deadline.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about because I like you mentioned, I think every team I think of that could use a center, especially more size, like I think the Pelicans are a team that I would love to see get an upgrade at the backup center position. But like again, Jakob is not a backup center right now monetarily, so that's pretty much impossible to do.
And like Clint Capella, right? Clint Capella is probably like, you know, he's nearing the point where like backup might make more sense for him as a role, but he only has 1 year left at $20 million. So if you really want a great backup center, if you're Dallas, for instance, like let's just say Dallas, right? You have Derek Lively and you feel like he's definitely your center of the future, but you want somebody who can pair with him long term or like pair with him as he continues to develop. Paying Clint Capella for one more year at $20 million makes a lot more sense than paying Jakob Poeltl three more years at $20 million.
Yeah, so, it's a lot more palatable.
Yeah, that's the Poeltl deal from a structural perspective never made a lot of sense to me as a trade. It really does not make sense now. So that's where Toronto is. Toronto's in a very complicated, difficult position, I think, to try and navigate.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to be fascinated to see how they deal with it, because there are so few options that it feels like there's a lot, if that makes sense. Like, it's mm-hmm. puzzling to look at, I think, is a better way to put it. So it's like, I'm just kind of going to be interested to see what direction they try and go in.
Well, and as you bring that up, they do have, at least they think, and honestly, like, I think so to an extent as well, they have the most important piece of it, which is you have Scottie Barnes, who at the very least is an all-star-ish caliber player, let's say, already. He might make the all-star team, he might not. Like, how would you, I'll look through all-stars, like, while we're talking in the East, just to, like, kind of make a list, but, like, he could theoretically be on a piece of the all-star, you know, team near the end of that roster. It wouldn't stun me. But long-term, like, he is an all-star. It's just whether or not he can be a top five guy in the league. I think that upside exists. I kind of refuse to put a ceiling on Scottie at this point. He continues to get better, continues to figure things out in such a real substantial way. They have a guy that, like, you can reasonably say might be that guy long-term, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have an answer to that, but might be. That's the most important thing. You have a second guy in Emmanuel Quickley who I think, like, if you told me he made an all-star game, like Fred VanVleet made an all-star game in Toronto, that wouldn't totally surprise me. I don't know if he's going to quite, like, reach the level of multi-time all-star and, like, all NBA guy, but I think that he has the ceiling to make, like, an all-star game long-term and be a top 12 point guard longer term in the NBA. Beyond that, I don't really know where they're going here. I think that Grady Dick, like, I would love to see Grady Dick get minutes. I know it's been a rough go so far in the G League, but, like, just put him out there and see what happens. Like, there's no reason not to at this point, especially late in the year. Maybe not, like, immediately, but maybe late in the year. Let's just kind of roll with it and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure where the Raptors go from here, but that seems like their core long-term trio. And then RJ Barrett as well, man. Like, I guess they have RJ for three more years after this one too. Like, what do you, man? Like, I'm, like, trying to figure this out. Like, what do you think of RJ's fit there now?
I've loved his fit so far, honestly. Like, that's one of the things that's been fun with Darko. I think, like, part of what's hard with a rookie head coach in this setting is, like, I'm with you. Like, I don't entirely know what to make of Darko yet, but I like some of the things he's done to maximize individuals. And part of it's just RJ has been playing well, but I feel like they've done a good job of empowering him so far and finding ways to utilize him. But again, like, I feel like it's hard to kind of evaluate him in the whole roster until we get, like, a real look at it being kind of competent in the same direction. But I think RJ is, like, when you look at what his contract is, I feel like you kind of have to mention him as part of the core right now, if that makes sense. But and he's played like it, so I don't know. This is already encroaching upon one of the best stretches that he's had consistency wise. So I don't know. We will see what happens.
Averaging 20 points, 7 rebounds, 3 assists on 56, 44, 76.
The 2-point shooting has been, like, the craziest part. Like, he has been so efficient and just making good decisions inside the arc.
Well, what I think there's that. And I think that they've done a better job of limiting his role a little bit, where, like, it's a lot, like, I think he's better in transition, obviously. And they've empowered him in that way because Toronto is obviously, like, always tried to, like, get up and go. I think you're right about, like, the better decision-making around the basket for RJ. That's been valuable and useful. Yeah, like, I think he's been better. Like, I think like, he's probably being given, like, the sounds like I'm talking shit, like, about Tibbs, and I actually don't mean it this way. Like, I think he's probably being given, like, more simple instructions, just like, hey, like, go score, right? Like, go get a bucket and, like, go. Like, it just feels a little bit easier for him to manage. Like, he feels like he's just going out there, reacting to what's happening around him and hooping a little bit. Whereas Tibbs is, you know, often telling people like 60 different things, which is why I think Tibbs can get a little bit frustrating for players if you don't have that kind of mentality. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. Okay. Last thing I want to talk about here on this deal. Do we think this has any wide-ranging impacts kind of league-wide at the deadline? Does this affect anything for any other teams at the deadline?
I think we've already seen it play out a little bit, but I do think that this makes an impact for the Kings. Obviously, they were interested in this. I do like to be fair, like I think with the Kings, they've been obviously they just had another really frustrating loss last night after being up pretty huge on the Suns. But I think still with that team, like they've shown good things. It's about kind of hitting that next stage in year two of them actually being a competent organization and continuing to do that. Like, what does that look like for them? Because I do think that they need to make something happen. Not that it has to be the big move, but clearly they're a team that's trying to find an upgrade. What does that mean for them? Because I do think like they are kind of the team that is most in line for that, them or Golden State. So I think for me, it's just going to be, what does that look like? Also, if you're Golden State, who are you adding that like really, like I've been on the, this season's kind of saying over is a lot, but I've been kind of just done with Golden State on that level for a couple weeks now. But I think this really puts the nail in the coffin for that. Like, if you can make the deal happen for Pascal, who are you getting that elevates this team like that? I don't think that there's a deal out there.
I don't think the season's over for Golden State.
Well, oh, okay. Over is a lot. But in terms of, like, being a team that is able to, like, really be a legit contender in the playoffs, I don't – like, I just think it's asking a lot for them to come back. And, like, yes, they had that one – that play-in run, but – okay, it's a very different Clay. It's a very different everything. Like, it just, I don't know.
So my thing is like the opportunity cost of this all, right? Like, who are they going to go get? Like, who's on the market that is a genuine difference maker for them? Like Bruce Brown, like could you convince Masai somehow to do Bruce Brown for Andrew Wiggins?
Yeah,
that is the thing that like would help them immensely right now. I don't see any world where that would happen, frankly. I mean, God, like that seems crazy. I think the Warriors would have to add substantially that. Like, could you do? I mean, this is an interesting one. Like, there's no way the Raptors do Wiggins and Moses Moody for Bruce Brown, like as a core trade, right?
I would not do that. I'm not touching the Wiggins deal with what it's looked like this year.
I don't think I would do that either, given how bad Wiggins has been. Like that's where that deal is at. Then again, though, if you're Toronto, like you have all of this cap space moving forward, you're pretty flexible books wise. If you really liked Moses Moody, that's interesting, right?
Yeah, like, yes, but I also think it just gets to a weird point because it's kind of – it's. I mean, I've tried talking about this, and I get that fans don't always, like, love hearing it, but I think part of the issue – and I'm not trying to absolve Steve Kerr of any lineups or end-of-game stuff, but I think part of the difficulty in having a guy on that contract that's guaranteed, like, you can't just not play him or you can't just completely demote them down the rotation because, like – part of what's become the issue for Golden State now, like we've just talked about, who wants to take that contract? So it's like, all right, if we don't get him back on track or we don't get this back to feasible, well, shit, how are we ever moving this or how are we ever making this a positive for us or for him? So I think, like, I understand Kuminga's frustrations and, like, frustrations fans have had with all that stuff too. But to me, it's like, okay – it's a lot easier to just sit a max contract player for the final 5 minutes of a game in practice than it is to actually do.
Yeah. I think I would not do Wiggins and Moody for Brown if I was Toronto. Not. I would definitely do it if I was Golden State. Golden State just needs like a shakeup in some way.
Yeah.
And like finding any way off of that Wiggins deal is your best bet to do so. even if it costs Moses Moody, who I really like and still am like a big fan of long term. And I think Moody would be like a fantastic fit.
I agree. I would love him there.
Next to Emmanuel Quickley and Scotty Barnes. That's why I'm like thinking about this. And I'm like, does that in any way work? I think I probably still wouldn't do it for Toronto, though, because like that is such a hard spot to be in. Other teams, like when guys like this get traded, like you think positionally around the league, right? Teams that could theoretically have been in the market for a four man like Siakam, right? Now they have another option off of the table. So, you know, people keep bringing up Oklahoma City. I never really thought Oklahoma City was interested right now, at least in somebody like Siakam.
Yeah.
I think they want to let their young guys kind of rock here, maybe help them with role player pieces, but not, you know, upset the apple cart with like another star deal right now. Detroit was one team, you know, Choms certainly has brought up Detroit looking for a four man at some point in the offseason or at the deadline. This is another option off the plate for them, along with OG Anunoby. So those options are quickly dwindling. Maybe it's, you know, Tobias Harris, maybe it's Kyle Kuzma, somebody like that. You know, trying to think of other teams that could have used like a legit four man. There aren't like a crazy, crazy number of them. Although like another team that is worth bringing up here, I think, is Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a team that we wanted to talk about a little bit today before this whole thing happened. Brooklyn, I think, is always been in the mix. Like any star's name that comes up, it feels like they at least like make a inquiry about it just to like kind of find out where it sits and what the lay of the land is. They're obviously looking for somebody like that. They feel like they have the role player pieces around, but they don't have the number one, frankly, maybe not the number two option either that they need. Now, this takes another, you know, potential number one, number two option off the plate for Brooklyn as they look to try and get this thing righted.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I think we'll have to talk about Brooklyn again at some point. But exactly like you're hitting on, like, it just makes things murkier for some of the other teams that were hoping to find this. And I think now, like, to me, because somebody asked in the comments, does this heat up Jeremy Grant's market? To me, yeah. I think Kyle Kuzma's next in line. Like, I would probably prioritize Kuzma over Grant if I'm a lot of teams. I don't know if you feel the same way. I guess
it would probably depend
on teams for me, but I think I would probably value Kuzma a little bit more right now.
Well, it's shorter deal and like a drastically better deal as well. You know, again, Kuzma in 2026-27 is going to be making like $19 million. Jeremy Grant's going to be making over 30 at that point. Like that is a significant amount of money. Like Jeremy Grant, I'll actually pull up the number. There's a non-zero chance Jeremy Grant is making damn close to double Kyle Kuzma's money in 2026-27. Yeah. So Kuzma is at like 19.2 that year. Jeremy Grant is at 34.2 in 2026-27. And oh, by the way, he's a player option for 36.4.
Jesus.
The next year.
Oh, so that's
a lot. That's a lot for Jeremy Grant. All due respect to his game. Jeremy Grant's an interesting one. Like Kuzma to me, you know, would be a real option for somebody. Bojan Bogdanovic would be an option for somebody. DeAndre Hunter would be an option for somebody. You know, if you're looking for a four, like they're out there, you can find them. Not quite as good as Siakam though.
Yeah,
definitely not quite as good as Siakam. Just a couple of other random questions here. Gary Trent Jr. or Chris Boucher to OKC. I don't see that. Sorry, Brandon. I don't know what he brings to Oklahoma City that, you know, somebody like Isaiah Joe or, you know, Lou Dort doesn't. With Bruce Brown, like Bruce Brown is bringing like connectiveness and toughness and like a bunch of stuff, like disruption defensively. Gary Trent's been like an okay at times defender, but he's not disruptive, at least in the way that somebody like Bruce Brown is. So that doesn't really line up to me. Somebody said the Thunder should try and get Bruce Brown and Poeltl. Maybe. like that's a big salary commitment for Poeltl. And like, if you're gonna do, if you're Oklahoma City, I don't think you do Poeltl. I think you do somebody like Daniel Gafford, or you just pay for Wendell Carter, maybe if he comes available in the summer. Yeah. Somebody like that. Like that, that makes a lot more sense to me. What do you see Utah doing now? Honestly, from what I know, like Utah really likes what they have going right now.
As like, they should, man. Like that, that is my favorite team to watch in the NBA right now.
They've been great recently. Like they have been fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. They are 22-20, ninth in the West. Look, like I think that they'll certainly listen. Like they always are willing to listen, but like, I don't see Markkanen moving. I've said that on the show for months now. I don't know. Like, I don't think they're enthused about moving like Jordan Clarkson. You know, I don't think they're like trying to move John Collins necessarily. If like, again, I think they'll listen and like, it's possible that something would happen there. And like they're expiring guys like Kelly Olynyk, Talen Horton-Tucker, like maybe some of those guys move. But yeah, if you told me they like stood pat, that wouldn't surprise me. Or if you told me that they lose some games here and they decide to, you know, move back in the standings, wouldn't surprise me either. I think that it's pretty open right now, but I lean toward them being a little bit quieter, I think, right now.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't really think it makes a ton of sense for them to move anybody, and like they don't have some massive reason to move somebody. Like you said, I think like Collins is maybe the only guy I'd look at as like maybe being, but he's been solid in Utah. I don't think that he's been like outstanding or amazing. Like he's been, you know, kind of what he was last year, but still just being a productive starter. I don't really see it like, cause I know a lot of people bring up Kelly Olynyk as a mover. Maybe if they really start to lose, but he's such a big part to what they do for winning right now. So I don't understand why he would be on the market. I agree. I don't really think that there's any reason for them to look to move anybody. If anything, they would be looking to, you know, add. And again, like there's not a star trade to be had. So I don't really know why they would be involved in any of it.
Yeah. I mean, look, like the reason to move Kelly is if you feel very comfortable with Lauri Markkanen, John Collins, Walker Kessler moving forward, plus you have Taylor Hendricks as well. Like that's your four. Then maybe you say, okay, like Kelly, you know, we love you. We'd love to keep you, but you know, as your career moves forward, you're a free agent. And if you're Kelly, like, I don't think you can go back there, right? Like you're going to lose playing time moving forward. So, you know, like I would probably look to move Kelly, but I think they're very happy with Kelly. So I don't know. Someone asked Schroeder trades. That's one that like, I truly just have not thought about yet. I have not gotten that far, if I'm being completely transparent. Teams that could use a point guard. I'm trying to think off the top of my head here. The Lakers, like that, reunite them in LA, but you know,
yeah, I'm looking up and down, and there's like not really anybody that I think.
Like, could the Pelicans use like a backup point? Maybe. Could the Magic use somebody like Dennis, like as a backup point?
See, the problem with Dennis too, if he's going to, because like he's not the guard that Orlando needs, because they already have like, obviously like they have Cole, who's been really good for them off the bench, but then like the points more like, okay, well we need like a guard who can shoot it. So I don't know. I don't know if I see one for him.
Yeah, I think like he's not been terrible. He's been solid in Toronto.
I don't mean anything on him. I just think when you're talking about what the contract is and what other teams need, I don't know if there's one for him.
There probably is. Like to be honest, like there probably is, because thinking about this, like he's on $12 million and $13 million. The way he's played this year, the way he played for Germany in the World Cup, that's a fine deal. Like there's nothing wrong with that contract. If somebody wants a backup point, like you could, or like even like a low end starting point, you could probably do worse, I guess. It's just, it'll depend on that. That feels like one that would get done near the deadline when teams like start running out of like other options that could be available, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, Mark, we had plans to do so many other things today, but we're not going to get to them because we've talked for an hour 20 and this Pascal Siakam deal happened. Mark, tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what's going on and everything else that you want to let them know.
Yeah. Well, first off, as always, appreciate you having me on, man. It's always a blast. We'll have to do it again sometime soon. Yeah, you can find me. Everything I do is over at 7-Star Digital, primarily at bettingodds.com right now. We'll have all meanings of things coming up. There's so many things going on in basketball right now. It's kind of hard to keep up with everything, but do my best. I have like four things going on tomorrow that'll all be publicized. So yeah, stay on the lookout.
Go follow Mark at MG_Schindler on Twitter. I had rookie rankings coming tomorrow. I don't know that they're coming tomorrow now because of this. This deal has obviously kind of changed some things. My guess is Monday at this point for rookie rankings, but I'm not 100% sure. I swear they're written. Like, I've done them all. They exist. I wrote about Vic, Hawkes, Brandon Pajemski, and Cam Whitmore. So you can go to The Athletic and read that whenever it comes out. I don't have an answer there yet. I'm sorry, guys. I will have something coming on the Siakam deal for sure. That is a no question, no doubter situation. That will happen. What else? Yeah, keep it locked here. We'll have awards at some point next week. Breaking down everything that's happening and talking about where I'd sit with my midseason awards, because next week, officially, I believe every team will have played 41 games. We've had a couple, I think, that are up at even like 42, if I remember correctly. I know Denver's at 41. I think Utah's at like 42 right now.
Yeah.
So they're past the halfway point. But there are some real fun award things to go through. So I'll try and grab somebody on the NBA side to come through, talk awards midseason. And that's all I've got. So until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.